that guy, that artist that had taken images of people looking at their phones.
Yes, with no phone.
And then removed the phone.
It's such a crazy thing we're doing. And now, of course, there's AR glasses that are eventually going to put whatever TikTok feed in like one eye where you're watching someone in the other eye.
Have you ever tried those?
I've messed around with them a little bit. Zuck was here and he let me try the new ones that haven't been released yet. They were really interesting. And you move a cursor around with your eyeballs and you can do things with your fingers. You can pinch and spread things and stuff with your fingers and play games with your fingers. You can like, it's not quite as responsive as you'd like it to be, but it's very beta.
Mm.
You know,
fuck, cool.
Pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
But also we're losing humanity. We're gonna be taken in. We're gonna incorporate with the machine.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think a lot of people feel like that would be a better version of the life that they have, and that's the saddest thing. That people of older generations look at young guys and girls and how much time they spend online, and they think, this is ridiculous. Why are they caring so much about what is occurring on the internet? But they don't realize people spend more time on screens than they do asleep. So the digital world is the real world for these people. Like the digital world is more real than the real world is.
Ooh, I didn't think of it that way. There are a lot of people that do spend more time on screens than they do asleep. That's really common.
Yeah,
I like to balance that out. I'd like to spend half as much time on my phone as I do asleep.
Well, that would be a good way to enforce it, right? You log how much sleep time you've had, and then
I'm gonna start sleeping 12 hours a day, so I can spend six hours wasting. It's quite a resource if you think about it, like a lack of an appreciation of your resource, because the resource of your time and your attention, it's very valuable. And you can convert it into all sorts of amazing skills and information and you know knowledge and change your whole life. Or you can just stare at stupid shit.
Now back to the podcast. But before, did you know only 1 in 5 listeners finishes an episode? That's why we summarize your favorite podcasts. Visit our website to learn more.
All day long.
It's so compelling though, dude. It's been designed by the most profitable companies on the planet with the smartest behavioral scientists in history. Like, it's an unfair fight. Mm. It really is an unfair fight. And that's why...
Sort of. You could not do it, though.
Oh, you need to lean in. But it's there is way more willpower you need to use in order to be able to not than, like, just whatever the course of natural human history is or natural human behavior.
Yeah.
Like, it's so easy to... Or, alternatively, you could dye the Venice River green. That's what happens when you don't have enough phone battery.
I sent that to Chris today. Greta Thunberg, she dyed the Venice canals green to protest a lack of action and climate change.
Yeah, pullback, a call to pull back carbon fuel in Europe. And they didn't just do it in Venice. They did it at 10 cities around Italy. But Venice has obviously got this gorgeous waterway. It's an entire city built on water.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hard to see how ugly it is. Jamie, I could send you a video of it because I sent Chris a video. It's, it's just like, how much attention do you need, lady? Okay? Stop.
Sky News Australia refers to her as a Swedish doom goblin.
Sky News is the one that's weirdly pro-Republican American politics.
Super right-wing.
It's like, who's funding that? There's no way that there's that much of an appetite in Australia for American politics.
Dude.
So that's what it looks like. That's disgusting. I was there this summer. It's fucking beautiful. Venice is so gorgeous and so ancient and so interesting. And to have this self-important twat pour a bunch of green dye into that water, you should go to jail for that. Like, you're ruining this experience for thousands and thousands of people who don't, not just the ones who live in that amazing place, but the ones who get to visit. I mean, someone figured out a way to make a whole city by shoving pylons into the ground. And they did it a long time ago. It's all wood. The whole city is stacked up on wood. They take these wood poles, they shove them into the ground. It's a specific type of wood that doesn't rot when it gets wet and waterlogged. It actually hardens. I forget what kind of wood it is. I watched this whole thing on it. But, I mean, it's very stable. I mean, sometimes they get some flooding. Like, one time we were there and, like, the lobby of this place was flooded. Mm. It does flood. But it's also, it's so fucking beautiful. And the architecture is so amazing. It's such a gorgeous place. And it just relaxes you like instantly when you're there. You're like, wow, I just want to have an espresso and eat some pasta and just chill out.
Last summer, it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
And this fucking dummy decides to just pour green dye. And how much green dye did you put in there? And what kind of an effect is that going to have on life?
So they claimed that it was environmentally safe, rah, rah. I don't know how environmentally safe anything of that green color can be. But yeah, what was it? 48-hour ban and a $170 fine.
That's it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You should go to jail for a night.
I think about this a lot, man. In some ways, I understand why the rhetoric gets more and more inflammatory. So if you care about an issue, if you really, really think that this issue is important,
mm-hmm.
and people don't listen, you start to shout a bit louder.
Right.
And then you shout a bit louder, and then you shout a bit louder.
The British are coming.
The British are coming. You know who first said that?
Wasn't Paul Revere.
Bonnie Blue.
Who's that?
She is the lady that slept with 1,057 men in a day.
Oh, that poor lady.
Yeah. People don't listen. Do you ever see Don't Look Up, that movie on Netflix?
That's very funny, by the way. I missed that joke because I didn't know
Jamie got it.
Who that was.
Jamie got it from over there, even with the
toothpick. I'm kind of proud that I can't recognize her name, though, honestly. I'll take that.
Yeah, it's probably a good sign. People don't listen. So Don't Look Up, that film with Leonardo DiCaprio a couple of years ago. You remember it was like an asteroid coming in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a funny movie, right?
Kind of, like half funny, but kind of it's supposed to be a comment on the impending doom of climate change. Nobody's listening, right?
Yeah, they're not correct. That's the problem. You know, who are those two gentlemen that we had in recently, Jamie? The guy from MIT and the other guy from, was he from Yale or Stanford? Where was he from? Anyway, these two brilliant scientists who have analyzed the data, and one of them was going over the understanding the equations that you would need to understand in order to really be able to calculate what is having an effect on the climate and how many different factors there are, and all of them working synergistically in some weird, unexplainable way. And then the cold, hard reality of climate data over the past X amount of millions of years, where it's always done this glaciation, and then the glaciers, they recede, and then you get higher ocean levels. It's like constant. Every 12,500 plus years, it goes up and down and up and down, and it never stays static, ever. It's never static. And the real fear is not global warming. The real fear is global cooling.
Why?
Global cooling kills everything. And we got that close at one point in history to having such a low oxygen level at this on this planet and such a low carbon dioxide level because there was no plant food, right? That these fucking plants almost died. We almost lost all life on this planet. We've gone like a few degrees from that happening. This is the glaciers are fucking scary. Ice ages are scary. When it gets warm, you just move. And I know that sucks if you're living in a city of 20 million people, but it hasn't happened yet. And they've been talking about it forever. That fucking stupid movie, An Inconvenient Truth, was wrong about everything. He should have to give back every fucking penny he made from that movie. You were wrong about everything. You scared the shit out of everybody, and you were 100% wrong.
One of the problems I think people have is if you really care about something and you're convinced, whether your conviction is incorrect or not, you're convinced by it. So what you do, you say a thing, people don't listen.
Right.
Say it a bit louder, people still don't listen.
Right.
Say it a bit louder again, people still aren't listening. And the problem is it's a misunderstanding about what compels and convinces other humans. What we think is, if people aren't listening, if I shout louder, they're going to pay attention. What we don't realize is that actually turns everybody off. Because if you just see someone throwing soup over a Van Gogh painting, turning the canals of Venice green, gluing themselves to the M25 in London, and stopping people from being able to get to work, like, it gets attention. But you're not looking for attention, you're looking for conviction. You're trying to compel people to believe the thing that you believe. And I think that it does the opposite. And I understand why it's so seductive, because you think it's cool to your own side to do something flaming sword-wielding truth teller, I'm going to charge through and look at how cool it is.
To fully grasp the profound impacts of human ingenuity in war, it's vital to understand how the decisions made by figures like Alan Turing shaped communication strategies during World War II. This leads to a gripping exploration of Turing's legacy and the moral complexities of wartime intelligence as the conversation unfolds.
It wasn't kinetic, it was cognitive. So he decodes the machine that the Germans are using to send their secret messages. This means that we're able to detect exactly where the U-boats are going to be, and it results in some really awkward situations, like if we, before we're going to use all of our force to try and take Germany down, if we avoid all of their planned bombings, they're going to guess that we might have the keys to some of their communication. So they had to start making decisions about which boats needed to be let attacked and which boats needed to be saved.
Oh my God.
They knew all of the different attacks that were coming, but if they got rid of all of them, if they were safe from all of them, the Germans would start to catch on. So they had this really...
Oh God.
So this guy is our equivalent of the atomic bomb, right? He's our Oppenheimer. He gets chemically castrated just after World War II.
It was in the 50s, right?
Yeah. And he kills himself. He takes his own life. He puts cyanide in an apple. Oscar Wilde, in the 1800s, one of the greatest writers of all time, he's jailed and then dies in exile as a peasant in France because he was gay. And then 70 years after Turing, Gordon Brown, it's like 2008, 2009, publicly apologizes. They bring out this thing called the Turing Act, which... gets rid of the criminal records of all of these people from history, like posthumous, and some of them are probably still alive, actually, like some of these people that had been, convicted of indecent behavior, improper behavior at the time. And then they put Turing on the £50 note. So Britain has, for all that it's fantastic and I love it and it's the country that I came from, like it does have a history of fucking persecuting people for what's deemed improper behavior at the time and then apologizing for it a couple of decades later. And I think with the online safety bill thing, just, I think it's going to be the sort of thing that you look back on and go, that was not, in no one's world was that a smart move. I don't think that it's helping anybody at all.
Well, it just appears that they want total, complete control over what people say over there and that they don't want criticism of the government, criticism about immigration, criticism about, you know, fill in the blank. They don't want it. And the best way to stop that is to keep everybody scared, make everybody self-censor. What's the best way to make everybody self-censor? Put a bunch of fucking people in jail. Last year, what was it, 12,000? 12,000 people got arrested for social media posts?
Supposedly more than Russia, although the Russian stats might not be.
Yeah. Well, they didn't arrest them. They just shot them in the face. They don't count
gulag,
that.
Gulag for you.
Yeah, they just kill folks over there. But yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad. And it just doesn't seem very progressive. It doesn't seem like you're moving towards the future. It's not progress. Like this, we figured out a long time ago that free speech is very important to figure out what's right and what's wrong. And when you suppress people's speech, you can get away with a lot of fucking horrible things because you stop people from being able to protest it. You know, and in a small part, we saw a lot of that during the pandemic. And, you know, and you see what the consequences of that are. You can't trust people that want power. You just can't.
What do you mean?
Anybody that wants any kind of control over a group of people, if you want to control what they say, if you want to control where they go, you want to put them in 15-minute cities, like, you can't trust that because the natural inclination when someone has power is to never let it go and to ramp it up. Mm-hmm. They're in the power business. If you're in the power business, you don't want to keep making the same amount of money every year. You don't want to have the same power every year. That's boring, right? Like if you're an insurance salesman, you want to be the fucking employee of the month. You want to make more money next year. You got your eyes on a new Lexus. You're trying to make more. You're not trying to stay maintained. That's not the game you're in. Mm-hmm. And if you're in the power game, and if you're in the game of enacting new laws, in order to have, we need safety. Safety. Under the guise of safety, you can get so much evil shit done. And if you start doing that, you're not going to say, you know what, guys, we were that safety bill. We were really wrong. And what's really important is discourse. What's really important is that maybe I wonder why you think the way you think. And, you know, maybe part of this polarization process is not enabling us to see valid points the other side has. Let's all come together and talk about this as reasonable human beings. No, that's not what they're going to do. They're going to just come up with more fucking reasons to put you in a cage. They want you to shut the fuck up because they want to make more. They want to have more. They want to get more power. They want to be the best leader. Mm. They want to be the most powerful leader.
Isn't that a ruthless part of human nature that trajectory is more important than position? Jimmy Carr taught me this. So your industry, imagine that you're the 250th best comedian in the world. Let's imagine there's a ranking. And last year you were the 300th. You were in a more psychologically preferable position than somebody who's number two in the world, but last year was number one. This sense right. that humans have of where am I now compared to where I was previously. I spoke to Dan Bilzerian about this forever ago, and I was like, dude, you've kind of climbed the peak of the mountain of hedonism. Did you ever think that you kind of front-loaded it too much and that it's going to be really, really difficult for you to ever like reset, like do a hedonic reset? How do you go from the most amount of girls and the cars and all the dopamine that the world has to offer? Like, where do you go from there? And he basically said, yeah, he was like, I'm going to try. I would consider shaving my head and my beard and going and working in an Amazon warehouse for 6 months to see if I can do like a hard reset. But you always know that you've got the get out of jail free card, so right. it's not going to be the same. And just the idea, as you're saying, somebody has power. They want more power.
Right.
They want more power. They want more control. That sense.
That's the sport they're playing.
Bingo.
Scoring. They're scoring. You have to keep score.
Greta Thunberg. The same thing. Yeah. We need more eyeballs. We need a bigger. Because where do you go after you've made the rivers of Venice green? Yeah. Like, well, you need to do something bigger, something more.
I need more likes. That didn't get me enough likes. I need more likes. I need to go viral.
It's a ruthless.
I'm being shadow banned.
No, you're not. Your content just sucks. No one. Like, some people get shadow banned, but most people that are shadow banned, they just suck.
Yeah, most people just don't understand that they're not interesting. But there's definitely real shadow banning going on. One of the things that was interesting is that once Elon purchased Twitter, I gained like 5 million followers over the course of like a couple of months. I was like, what's going on? It's because I was somehow or another, they had locked my followers down. I'm not complaining about this. I'm just observing. I know I have a lot of followers. It's ridiculous. But I started, I think I had 7 million. And I used to go up pretty steady. And then somewhere during the woke days, during the dark days of woke, when it all started happening, which is around, I think, 2014, 15, 16, it started really ramping up. And then it seems like from 16 on, real censorship started really kicking into high gear because then they had a reason for it. Donald Trump is our president. We have to make sure this never happens again. In fact, there was a meeting, I believe, I don't want to say the tech company because I might be incorrect, but one of the main people at this tech company specifically said at the meeting, we have to make sure this doesn't happen again.
As in Trump
being president.
Oh, they fucking horrendous job there.
Well, they fucked up. But the point being, imagine you are in control of an enormous platform, an enormous media platform that controls the discourse of untold billions of people in the world, and you have a very specific mandate that you've given to the people that work for you. We have to make sure that we control who the king is. Because that's what you're saying. We got to make sure this doesn't happen again? Well, how do you do that? How do you do that if 50% of the people don't agree?
By force.
There's only one way. You have to do it by force. Or if you control the narrative, then you just hide information, accelerate information that's incorrect. You just ban people from communicating. You kick people out.
Well, I mean, some people would say that getting to choose who's king is what you do if you then buy that social media platform.
Sure. There's an argument for that. Like what Elon did, there's a real argument for that. But there's also an argument for, don't you think it's a good idea if we have at least one of these motherfuckers that's huge that you can go wild, wild west on and say whatever you want? I think that's very important. You don't have to agree with them. There's all these tools you can use. One of them is the mute button. You can mute people. Bye-bye. I don't want to hear you anymore. You're annoying. Or you can ban them. I don't even want you looking at my page. Get out of here. Those things exist. Like, you can curate who you're communicating and interacting with. But if you don't have one of these groups that's resistant to intelligence agencies shutting down legitimate voices, including during the COVID times, it was guys like Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, guy from MIT, because they were saying something that didn't jive with what the agenda that Fauci was pushing through.
Where do you think we're at now, if you were to sort of predict what the trajectory of the speech stuff is online? Talk about America, UK, I think is just a lost cause.
Understanding the nuanced discussions around malinformation and free speech is crucial as we venture into the competitive landscape of boxing. With rising tensions regarding fairness in sports, especially involving gender identity and competition integrity, The next conversation dives into the transformative dynamics of figures like Anthony Joshua and Jake Paul. How will their upcoming match challenge perceptions in the boxing community?
Terrifying. Again, a guy who survived Usyk twice. You know, you saw what Usyk did to Dubois. You see Usyk take out Dubois? Did you see that? Mm. I mean, that's the Usyk you're talking about. There's an Usyk that rocked Tyson Fury, who's fucking 6'9".
So Jake Paul's 6'1". Yeah. Versus 6'6" Anthony Joshua. Jake weighed in for the Tyson fight at 199.
Yeah.
Joshua against Ngannou was 252.
6'6". Not just 6'6", but 6'6", and knows how to use every fucking inch of it. Knows how to keep that stick in your face. He was keep that jab in his face, and that right hand, if it hits you, you're fucked. And he's not worried about you the way he's worried about Usyk. You can't move like Usyk. You can't constantly be frustrating and overloading his nervous system. Usyk is overloading every aspect of your senses at every moment. He's constantly moving, and then punches are coming, and he loops punches around your guard, and he's constantly shifting his feet, and you think he's going to be there, and he's over here, and it's like this overload of thinking. It's not a casual, relaxed fight where you can kind of move around and get your groove and he's going to stay on the outside and you're going to... No, it's just constant. He survived that guy twice. He survived, in my opinion, the most skillful heavyweight of all time. Twice. And you're going to go box him? And the toughest guy you fought before was 40 years old Anderson Silva? That was the toughest guy so far you fought? You've lost to Tommy Fury, who's a very good boxer, but this is a giant Olympic gold medalist heavyweight. I mean, Anthony Joshua is fucking terrifying.
He is the thing that nightmares are made of.
And he's got that one punch nuclear power. One punch. And he's fast. It's an like there's certain guys that, like, in kickboxing couldn't translate over to MMA because they didn't have the kind of speed. Like Peter Arts is a good example. He was a world-class kickboxer, one of the best of all time, but didn't have the style that would allow him to train. But then there was Mirko Krokop. Mirko Krokop, who was violently explosive, would perfectly transition to MMA because you got to be able to hit people quick. It was like a big part of it is speed. Anthony Joshua has that kind of speed. That it's a, you kind of
with 252
like,
pounds.
If you don't
it.
Have the skill to get away from that kind of power, what happens is Francis Ngannou and Anthony Joshua. You have to be a very... You can't judge that guy based on Dubois, who's a fucking murderer. Daniel Dubois is a tank, and he took out Joshua. But that guy's fucking terrifying. You're staring in front of that guy. But Usyk didn't stand in front of him. Usyk moved all over the place. Joshua's... And he's going to have a lot to prove. He's going to be very angry.
Do you think they'll let everybody take the breaks off? Because there's all rumors about Tyson versus Jake that both of them were sort of pulling punches and not fully letting it go.
I think that's a different deal. You know,
do you think there was something probably just below the table?
I do not know. I do not know if it was said. I do not know if it was understood. I do not know.
In your professional opinion, based on what you saw, do you think that the people were holding?
Definitely looked like sparring. But it could be that he didn't want to hurt Mike Tyson because Mike Tyson's 58 years old. Or it could be that Mike Tyson didn't want to hurt him because he likes him. I don't fucking know. But it wasn't what I was tuning in for.
It was not for me. I was there. I went to it live.
I was tuning in for Mike Tyson coming full 1988 Mike Tyson, full chaos. That's what I was hoping for.
We walked out like that.
It looked like it. Yeah, but that's what everybody signed up for. So they got us. Whatever.
And do you think that...
This is different. I don't think this is that. I don't think this is that at all. First of all, it can't be that. Because Joshua is still competitive in the heavyweight division. And he's only doing this for money. Like, he's still set up for world title fights. After he knocked out Ngannou, you could still set him up, like Joseph Parker just lost. You could set him up with Joseph Parker. You could have,
until
a year ago, he could fight Deontay Wilder.
You're saying that the lineage and the trajectory that Anthony Joshua is on, if he happens to go a little bit too gentle and lose by decision to Jake Paul, it doesn't exactly look great for his future heavyweight chance.
It fucks up all of his marketing opportunities.
Wow. So that's a really... So what we were saying before...
The Ngannou fight is a godsend to him, right? The Ngannou fight is like, hey, boxing's back. This guy knocked down Tyson Fury. This is how it was supposed to go. Anthony Joshua, you carried the torch for the boxing community. Because I know a lot of like straight up boxers, they absolutely felt that way. Yeah. Like, this is what needed to happen. These guys can't come over from MMA and think they can box the best.
Yeah, you need to put them in their place. What's great there, and it loops back to what we were talking about before, is incentives, align the incentives.
Yeah.
Like, if you've got Joshua's... I mean, this is...
However, I should...
Caveat.
Yeah, here's the caveat. This might earn him $200 million. So if it earns him so much money.
Joshua or Jake Paul?
Joshua. Like, either one. How much money is involved?
$200 million?
Oh, dude. This is a Saudi organization, right? This is Riyadh season. Isn't this that was putting this on?
Probably. They seem to own everything. I think they own me now. Well, and you and Jamie and Carl.
It's Netflix, right?
Right, yeah.
This is going to be on Netflix. Uh-huh. Okay, so I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe Riyadh season's not involved. But the money they threw Canelo Alvarez to get him to fight Terrence Crawford, this is like they're throwing insane money. They're throwing nutty sums of cash at people to make amazing fights happen. Like this has always been the hiccup in boxing, is that people don't want to fight certain people because they want to protect their record. The Saudis are like, how much?
Everybody's got a price.
Yeah, everyone's got a price.
And we've got the bank
how
account
much?
To pay it.
So here it is. The reported total prize purse for Jake Paul versus Anthony Joshua is $184 million, with an even split expected, meaning each fighter will earn approximately $92 million. Some reports initially suggest a different figure. 184 is the most frequently cited total from sources like Daily Mail and Wikipedia. Okay, that doesn't mean anything. Some have also mentioned Jake Paul's cryptic $267 million tweet, which may have fueled rumors. Really depends on who's setting it up. Netflix doesn't have to tell you how much they're paying, but the thing about Anthony Joshua, if he loses this, so let's say he's only getting the $92 million, which I bet he's getting more. Let's say he's getting $92 million. If he loses this fight, he misses out on that Saudi money because they could set up a Tyson Fury Anthony Joshua fight, and each one of them gets $200 million. You could do a fight like that. The Saudis can do a fight like that. They can do a fight. They have enough resources to throw at boxing where they could change the entire landscape of boxing.
If you were the guy that stands in between 6'6", 250-pound Anthony Joshua and $200 million.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I don't think he's going to lose to you on purpose.
I don't want to be that guy.
But I'm not saying that anybody lost to anybody on purpose. I don't think that's happened. But what I do think is that people take it easier on people if they like them. And it looked like they were taking it easier on each other than you'd expect. I'll just say that. It's just my personal opinion. I don't think that's going to happen with this fight. I don't think there's any chance in the world, knowing what Anthony Joshua is a specialist at, he's a specialist at putting knuckles through your fucking brain, you know, and that's what he's going to try to do to Jake Paul. And anything other than that, from a 34-year-old Anthony Joshua, will make us all think it's a fixed fight. Whether or not Joshua can do it, whether or not, I mean, Jake Paul shocks the world and shows us that he really does know how to box really well and moves really good and uses his jab and blows us all away with a strategy and a lot of footwork and movement and brings Usyk into his camp or Lomachenko's dad, even better, who's the guy who trained Usyk. He trained Usyk as well, Lomachenko's father. That's why they both are the best moving fighters in this generation by far. They're in a group of the greatest of all time, like Willie Pep and Pernell Whitaker. There's like a group of like defensive wizards that exist today that are in that group. And two of them that exist in that group are trained by the same guy, Lomachenko and Usyk.
I don't want to be Jake. That's what I
mean. Yeah, fuck that.
I do not want to be.
But what better way to show the world you're legit? Go get knocked out by Olympic gold medalist, former world heavyweight champion, 6'6", 250 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, it's
show the world you're in it to win it.
You're definitely not fucking about. I had this guy on my podcast, Bugsy Malone. So he's a British grime artist. And he had this home.
What's a grime artist?
Like drill, rap. Like British
rap. Okay. Did you know what that meant?
You did? Damn. Keep up with the times.
I can't. It's too late. I missed everything.
He grows up in the north of the UK in gangs, Manchester. And he's in juvenile detention. As a teenager, he gets stabbed with a screwdriver. Like rough stuff. Rough northern stuff. But some part of his upbringing just sort of really compels him to try and bring himself out of this situation. Starts making music, gets super successful, does this Fire in the Booth with Charlie Sloth that gets like 35 million plays. And he starts boxing. Boxing is like one of his salvages. It's one of his safe havens. And it's one of the things that's kept him very disciplined throughout his whole life. So he starts accumulating some money and he buys a nice house in Manchester, very, very nice house. And the local kids nearby sort of starting to take a little bit of notice. Maybe they know who he is as an artist, and word starts to get around that he's living there. And there'd been some concerns, some security concerns for a little while.
Before diving into the latest discussions about keyboard efficiency, it's crucial to understand Bugsy's unexpected confrontation that tested his mental and physical readiness. This remarkable incident and its legal aftermath reveal a fascinating blend of personal growth and street smarts. Now, how does this tie in with the comparisons to typing speed and efficiency?
I think.
Up and right.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Hot swap dactyl.
Maybe. That's just for sale, though.
What is it? It's still a QWERTY keyboard. Still, you can't get away from it.
So there's
other layouts.
If you could search what styles of key, what is the most efficient layout of keys for typing speed?
That's what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I asked. This, what's coming up? This shit is way faster than typing.
Okay. Yeah. Right. But that's a different thing.
It's fastest keyboard for typing. That's what comes up.
You can type. Hold on. Let's look at that for a second.
You haven't seen this before?
No.
Yeah. It's like how the directions. They. I'll show you on a demo.
Wow.
This is crazy.
And each one of those is a letter, and some of them
you can make words real fast.
Oh. This is a, what we're talking about right here is a totally different device than a keyboard. But what I mean is, like, there's another keyboard layout that super nerds use. Of course. Like a tiny amount. Like the kind of people that have, like, they have those Google phones that don't connect to the servers, you know?
Didn't Eric Prince make those?
No, that's a different one. Okay. He's got his own.
Yeah, just that path dependency thing, like shit from the past that's still influencing us now.
Yeah.
Why your shirt is going in the other direction.
That's pretty crazy. Okay, so here it is.
Is a new class of peripheral device that allows ordinary people to type at the speed of thought.
Whoa.
Everything your keyboard can and much more. Whether you're coding, gaming, designing, or just typing, whatever you do, it at the speed of thought.
I wonder how much of a learning curve there is to figuring out how to type with that thing, because it looks pretty dope. Ooh, they have different ones. Scroll up to that image at the top. That's a different one.
I think it's the same. It's just
but shape different.
Yeah, just like made out of metal.
Right, but it's a different shape.
You probably put your hand. Well, maybe put your hands on it the same way.
It's very different. The other one was curved.
The problem that you have is
is this the new one? The Forge, Master Forge. Let me see what you got here.
It's not showing anybody to use it. That's how I was trying to find a good way using it to show you how they type like words really fast.
I think it's a matter of time before you're typing with your brain anyway. I think this is like learning to code.
Yeah, well, I think about this with prompt engineering. Like, if AI gets progressively better and better, the idea of being a prompt engineer, I understand how to get the AI to do what I want, is a job that only shortly after it becomes a job might be made completely obsolete.
100%. Yeah. Yeah, that's not going to work. That's like opening up a Blockbuster video in 1999. It's like, they've so little time.
Well, the problem that you have with the QWERTY keyboard thing is it's a coordination problem. Like, if you want to borrow your friend's laptop, unless everybody decides, we're going to switch to the better type of keyboard and we're going to do it now.
There you go.
Finally. Oh, here he goes. He's moving.
He's typing it right there. He's typing these words as he's looking at the screen.
Holy shit.
How's he doing that? That guy's a fucker.
300 words a minute, I think people can get to.
But here's the question. Like, how do you learn? Do you have to play a game? Do you ever do that? Like Mavis Bacon's typing? Do that?
No, what was that?
It's fun. It's a game you play. It teaches you how to type.
Teaches you how to type?
Yeah, you like type things that they tell you to type. They time you like a race. It's like fun.
So he's like hitting all these letters at once, I think, with his fingers. You can see him popping up, and then it creates the word. I think it's a little bit of a mixture of like, do you remember the T9 typing you could do on your phone?
Yeah.
And you could hit four numbers and you know what word it would be, and if it wasn't that word you'd hit next like three times. You get really good at that. I think it's a mixture.
Like predictive.
Could you rewind that again so I could see him doing that? Can you give me some volume so I could hear what he's saying?
There's no question that typing sentences at over 200 words per minute is extremely satisfying, but does typing fast actually transfer to productivity in the real world? That's the question we'll be answering together in today's video. Does typing speed really matter?
That's nuts.
Wow.
He just did that. Wow. And he made butt large.
Yeah.
Like he made it all caps. Like
I suppose this is kind
of... I need to know if that dude's Rain Man. You know what I'm saying? I need to ask him some questions about math.
Yeah, it's mad to think how quickly we can think and how slowly we can communicate that to other people, even with speech.
Can you just please search, is there a more efficient key layout than QWERTY? Because that's what I'm looking for. Because I know there is. Because I remember I went down a rabbit hole with this, and I was really thinking about trying it. And then I was like, God, what are you doing?
You'd have to change your phone.
Yeah, and it wasn't phone days. This was way before phone days. This was the days of just typing. More efficient keyboard layout than QWERTY. That's it. Dvorak. That's it. Puts about 65 to 70% of keystrokes in the home row versus roughly 30 on QWERTY. So fingers move much less. So now that we know that, can you search for images of Dvorak keyboard. So that's what the keys look like right there. Oh, that's it right there. See how different that is?
Wow.
Yeah. Very different.
How long do you reckon it would take you to write out a short email?
It would take forever. My stupid fingers would go right back to where they always go. You know, that was one of the things that I learned really early on from teaching martial arts. I would way rather teach someone who didn't know anything than teach someone who learned things wrong. Because someone who learned things wrong, it's very difficult to correct their technique. They have a mode in their mind that they shift to when they're panicky or when they're being pressured. They always go back to the bad technique, always. It's very hard to get someone to learn technique correctly when they know it incorrectly. You got to reteach them everything. You see it with pool. There's certain tendencies that people have with their arm being out. A lot of people just accept the bad relationship between your elbow and your, as long as it's consistent. Even though it's more inefficient, it's going to add extra English to the ball and spin and all these different things, and probably make you less accurate. Maybe better that than try to like make your arm drop down and hang 90% because it'll feel so alien. Mm. But that's way less than in martial arts. In martial arts, like, God, if you learn how to throw a sidekick with your knee down versus your knee up, it's so hard to do it the other way. When you're being pressured, you're always going to do it the wrong way, and you're not going to have the correct amount of power. And those tendencies that are burned into you, I've been typing for 30 fucking years. Like, I don't have to look at a keyboard. I can just talk to you, and I can type, and I'm not really good, but I'm good enough. Mm. You know, I don't look at the keys. Like, I don't have to peck. Like, it used to drive me crazy watching videos of Hunter Thompson, who never learned how to type. He would type like this. He would type with like one finger at a time, poke and peck. I'm like, dude, it would take so little time for you to just put your fucking fingers there and learn how to do that right. He never did. He poked and pecked his way to some of the greatest fucking books ever.
Maybe that was a performance enhancer. But yeah,
Well, he was poking and pecking when he was on coke.
That's
so
true. Yeah, it's probably for the best that he didn't type more quickly. Imagine the crazy shit that would have come out of him then.
Right, yeah. You ever seen him type? It's so frustrating.
No. Can we see? Is it videos?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Find Hunter Thompson typing. Yeah, you'll see it. It's pokey-pecky. And Johnny Depp actually mimicked it really accurately in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. When he's sitting in front of the thing, like, pecking. Yeah, like doing his Hunter Thompson impression, poking. Yeah.
Well, your brain can think at about 4,000 words a minute. And that's the same rate of fire as an M134 machine gun.
Having explored cutting-edge communication technology, the discussion now shifts to the emotional complexities faced by individuals at the pinnacle of success. What happens when achieving dreams results in unexpected hollowness? Listeners will discover how champions like Scottie Scheffler grapple with fulfillment versus ambition in their pursuits.
That's one of the things I learned like really early on from this guy, Mike Donovan, who was one of like the big comics in Boston. He goes, always record your sets because you never know when you're going to say something. And it'll be lost forever if you don't have a recording.
There was a Scottie Scheffler, a golfer. He won. Jamie, you'll have seen this video. Yeah, can we get that? There's a New York sports video like cut. He does this. It's such a fucking cool explanation of what somebody who's got to the peak of their sport, the absolute pinnacle, like in the moments of winning. Mm. And he just breaks the fourth wall open about kind of the hollowness of what this is.
Really?
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
Like, what's the point, that thing?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And it's just such a fucking great explainer. Because we always assume, here we go.
Let me hear this.
He might have just won the US Open here too, by the way. Which is like the biggest event of the year.
Life, it's fulfilling from the sense of accomplishment, but it's not fulfilling from a sense of like the deepest, you know, places of your heart. You know, I think it's kind of funny. I think I said something after the Byron this year about like, it feels like you work your whole life to celebrate winning a tournament for like a few minutes. It only lasts a few minutes, that kind of euphoric feeling. And I like to win the Byron Nelson Championship at home. I literally worked my entire life to become good at golf, to have an opportunity to win that tournament. And you win it, you celebrate, get to hug my family, my sister's there. It's such an amazing moment. And then it's like, okay, now what are we going to eat for dinner? You know, life goes on. Is it great to be able to win tournaments and to accomplish the things I have in the game of golf? Yeah. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes just to think about, because it's literally worked my entire life to become good at the sport, and to have that kind of sense of accomplishment, I think is a pretty cool feeling. You know, to get to live out your dreams is very special. But at the end of the day, it's like, I'm not out here to inspire the next generation of golfers. I'm not here to inspire somebody else to be the best player in the world, because what's the point? You know, this is not a fulfilling life. It's fulfilling from the sense of accomplishment, but it's not fulfilling from a sense of like the deepest, you know, places of your heart. You know, there's a lot of people that make it to what they thought was going to fulfill them in life, and then you get there and all of a sudden you get to number one in the world, and then they're like, what's the point? And you know, I really do believe that, because you know, what is the point? You're like, why do I want to win this tournament so bad? That's something that I wrestle with on a daily basis. It's like showing up at the Masters every year, it's like, why do I want to win this golf tournament so badly? Why do I want to win the Open Championship so badly? I don't know, because if I win, it's going to be awesome for about 2 minutes. And then we're going to get to the next week, and it's going to be like, hey, you won two majors this year. How important is it for you to win the FedEx Cup playoffs? And it's just like, we're back here again, you know? So we really do. We work so hard for such little moments. And, you know, I'm kind of a sicko. I love putting in the work. I love being able to practice. I love getting out to live out my dreams. But at the end of the day, sometimes I just don't understand the point.
That's honest. That's what that is. That's
I love that video so much.
That's why he's so good.
I love that video
guarantee
so much.
You that's why he's so good, because I guarantee you that guy has to be that honest with himself about everything. Otherwise, you'd never fix the hitch in your swing, you know? You have to be honest about every single thing. You have to be aware of all of it. Every little weird fucking thing you do. Why am I doing this? Like, what is the point of this? And then when you're done, like, yeah, I did it. And then it's going to creep right back in,
Nike did
a
commercial after that. And it's him with his son sort of kneeling down on the green. And it says, you've already won. And then I think the next slide is, but let's get another one. And it's so fucking cool, dude. There it is. You've already won. But another major never hurt. That was it.
Wow.
Bruh. Yeah. Fucking unbelievable. Yeah. So I think I kind of become obsessed with people sacrificing what they want, which is happiness, for the thing that's supposed to get it, which is success. Mm-hmm. So they sacrifice the thing that they want, being happy in the moment. They make themselves miserable in order to be able to achieve a thing, so that when they finally have sufficient success, they will allow themselves to be happy. And it's like a very strange trade. Imagine if you had some simultaneous equation and you just crossed off success from both sides, you would sort of be left with happiness. I think that's unrealistic, right? Because we need social validation from people, and we want to be recognized. We want to do stuff, and we've got to put food on the table, and social creatures and all the rest of it. But I think videos like that are really important for people to see when they look up to someone about how much there is there at the end of the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
Like Elon was on Lex's show a couple of years ago, and I think Lex asked him some question like, how are you doing? He replied and he said, people think they want to be me. They do not want to be me. They don't know. They don't understand. My mind is a storm. I'm like, that's the price you need to pay to be Elon Musk.
I think that was on this podcast.
Was it this one?
Yeah, because I asked him, like, what is it like to be you? Like, he's like, you wouldn't want to do it. You wouldn't want to be me. And you could tell, like, when you're in his eyes, like, it's not a normal thought process. It's like this chaotic tornado of ideas that's running around in his head. You know, and that sometimes he spits them out on Twitter and they're not good.
Well, it's a problem when you own the platform, right? It's kind of like, I can say what I want, it's my own house.
Well, he can though, like, but he's like that all the time. He's fun. He's like what I would want to see from a guy who's a super genius, like a playful guy who wants to go to Mars, who's making, like, Jamie and I went on a tour of SpaceX whatever the fuck it is. We saw the launch. We went to the SpaceX launch. Mm-hmm. And so we got a tour of the rocket factory, which is fucking insane. It's so much more insane than I thought it was going to be. I don't know how much we could even say, but it is nuts. It's nuts. And the sheer quantity of rockets that they're making is mind-blowing. Like, you're like, I thought they had a couple rockets. You know, just a couple rockets laying around. They're just making rockets.
I'm pretty sure they've put more stuff into space, just that one company, than like the entirety of the load that's being transported into space globally up until now.
They
like,
put stuff in space for their competitors. Yeah, they use their space rockets to put stuff in space for people that they're in competition with. They take the money.
Show me the color.
Like, we know how to do it. We're better at it than you, so we'll do it.
Fucking unbelievable, dude.
It's kind of nuts.
I think about that, like the sort of person you need to be to drive that, though.
It's a different kind of person, right? Like, that's what he wants to do, and that's what he desires to do. And, you know, this gentleman talking about golf, like, this is a different, that's a totally different thing, because he's in a competition all the time, you know? And it's really hard to just enjoy the process when you're in this competition where, especially if your livelihood depends upon a very specific result. Like, you have to be better at this thing than everybody else. Not just do the best yourself, but better than the other people that are also doing their best. So you're in this constant, just never escaping this pressure. Fighters feel that, I think, more than anybody, because it's like an actual physical person coming to harm you all the time.
And you're very outcome-focused.
Yeah.
I'd say it's all well and good him saying, I love the process, I'm a bit of a sicko, I like my training, so on and so forth. But it's very different saying, I enjoy the process of training when you've just won, than I enjoy the process of training when you've just come second or fifth or 20th.
Right.
And especially if you're laid out flat on the canvas.
Yeah, oh, especially that.
If that's the humiliation.
There's also the damage that was just done to you where you might not, really might not be the same again. And there's certain fighters that you could point to one fight and they never recovered from it.
Yeah.
Meldrick Taylor versus Julio Cesar Chavez is my personal one that I always point to. Because Julio Cesar Chavez knocked him out with, like, I think it was like a couple seconds left in the last round. Stopped him. And it was a fight that Meldrick Taylor was winning a decision. But Julio Cesar Chavez was wearing him down. He was one of the greatest of all time. Just ripping the body, constantly attacking him. And eventually broke him down, had him in a corner, boom, dropped him with a right hand. And he got up, and the referee called the fight with, like, a couple of seconds to go. And it was a hugely controversial call. But then when Meldrick Taylor returned, he was never the same again. He started slurring his words really badly.
So that's physical issue.
He's getting knocked out easily. He's getting dropped easily. It was gone. It was all gone. That fight just took it all out of him. You see that? So there's that too. It's not just you're going to lose a golf tournament. Like, you might get your brains punched in.
Physical repercussions.
Huge physical repercussions. For a vicious knockout, huge. Some guys are never the same again. And much more likely to get knocked out again once they get knocked out really badly.
Who do you think of all of the people that you know has got the right balance of is successful and is also having fun at the same time? Because it seems like that's a trade that a lot of people can make. Where they are successful, but they sacrifice their happiness. Or they're kind of happy, but they're not pursuing external successes in the same way.
Chappelle's journey embodies the balance between passion for comedy and the struggle for greatness, revealing his continuous quest for the art. This mindset is crucial as the upcoming discussion delves into the significance of appreciating simple pleasures, which often elude those chasing larger milestones. How can recognizing small joys transform our experience?
The fuel that gets you there is how much you love what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking.
That's what gets you to the dance.
Correct. I've been thinking so much about the shame of simple pleasures. So there's this quote from a guy called Visakan Barasamy that says, I have not yet grown wise enough to deeply enjoy simple things. And I just love the idea of it, that most of us are kind of terrible accountants of our own joy, yes. That we only accept deposits when the transaction's large enough, right? The day that we get married or the night that we play the main stage at Glastonbury or sell out the arena, anything less than that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even make the ledger. So we treat small pleasures like counterfeit currency. And we think like, we have a kind of, not disgust, but rejection of, oh, that small thing made your week. That tiny incident made your day. You must not have a lot going on. Like, how weak and how small must your life be that seeing a cute golden retriever this afternoon was like a fucking sick part of your day?
And
I think about Scottie Scheffler as a good example. Him making it all the way to the top. And if all that you were doing was waiting for that final moment, for this main stage at Glastonbury, day that I get married, sell the biz for $500 million, whatever, you are forgetting almost all of the journey and then just cashing in at the destination. And as the guy that's just won everything in all of fucking golf, like the GOAT of right now, is saying, it's fleeting.
Yeah.
It's really, really short. It's not going to last for very long. And that shame that people have, I certainly know that I do as well, that it almost feels like a reflection on the smallness of my life if I take pleasure in little things. But when you take pleasure in little things, you don't just get more of them. You get them right now. You don't need to wait. You don't need to like be a fucking world champion at the winning the marshmallow test, just delaying gratification so long that you never actually end up getting any gratification.
Yeah. The problem with that thought process is to achieve true greatness, you must be mad. Madness and greatness are inextricably connected. You can't separate them. To get true greatness, you have to. There has to be some demons. There has to be a mad struggle in your mind, and you have to want it so badly. You want to have to want that result so badly that you are willing to put in more time, more effort, more focus, more hours, and just you don't get to smell the roses, man. You don't. You don't get to pet the puppies. You do, but you don't. You're petting the puppy thinking about the thing that you do, thinking about getting better because you need those resources.
It's like a demon that sort of climbs inside of you and wears you.
Yeah.
You know
who Ronnie O'Sullivan is?
Yeah, the snooker player.
Yeah, the greatest of all time. Like, yeah. There's certain people in certain sports. I'm going to send you something, Jamie, so you see what a wizard this guy is. I'm actually in the middle of his book. My friend Billy Thorpe, who's a top flight pool player, recommended this book. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Tyler Styler, who's another top flight pool player, like world-class pool player, recommended this book. And I started the book, and I can't stop it. It's so good.
How old is it?
I think it's fairly recent because it's post-COVID. I thought it was going... He recommended it because of the way Ronnie describes picking the perfect cue, like the relationship that he has with the cue. But it is so eloquent and so... But the story of his life is really more of... It's an exercise in him trying to explain like what it's like to be this good and this mad. Like he's a madman. Like watch this. Watch what he does here. This is crazy.
Here from O'Sullivan.
Now, if you don't know how difficult it is to make these balls, he doesn't give a shit that guy's in front of him, that the referee's in front of him. Watch how quickly he does this. I mean, he's making the audience laugh. He's moving around that guy. He can't miss. This is the zone personified. He gets to a point in this where he's feeling so good, he decides to start shooting things one-handed. Watch this. One-handed.
Now he's doing it one-handed.
These are tiny little pockets. He's shooting one-handed with English and getting position. Everyone's going crazy. I mean, that's how fucking good Ronnie O'Sullivan was. Like...
Oh my God.
But the book is really about managing madness. It's about him being sober, and now he's trans. He's kind of taken a lot of that insane competitive drive. Now he runs like he's a runner, like he runs long distances. Mm-hmm. And he talks about that, meets up with his running club, and they all get together and go on runs together. But it's like, it's just managing whatever the fuck that. And he's also describing, even in his prime, he was thinking he's worthless. He's thinking he's not good enough. He's going to fall apart. Mm. He's going to choke. He's going to this. And that. He's like, all these demons are popping up. And meanwhile, everybody's like terrified of him. He shows up. It's like, oh, geez, the genius is here. Because he's a genius. Like, he's a snooker playing genius. There's something about what he does that's just different than everybody else. But the book is like, it's not just about like picking the perfect cue. It's really about managing madness. And everyone who's great is fucking crazy. But you can, I think, like Chappelle does, you can take that greatness and just throw it into the thing you do and love it while you're doing it. You can't, it doesn't have to be a demon. It doesn't have to be an adversary. Mm. It could be like just this romantic affair of you being so fortunate to be able to pursue this thing, but maintaining that same level of enthusiasm. I don't know if the same level of enthusiasm, though, can be maintained in something that has like a winner and a loser, like a game where there's so much riding on
binary
each shot.
Outcome.
Yes, versus art, which is like Dave goes to, he's already won. The show's sold out. He knows how to do comedy. He gets out there, they all cheer. He's got great material. He can't wait to make them laugh. He already won.
The problem with turning the art into the competition.
Yeah.
She said there, right? Yes. The rankings. Well, that means that even if I did it and enjoyed it, but I'm number three or whatever.
Yeah.
That's horrendous. That's not good. Yeah.
There's podcasts that game the system. So this podcast, they release multiple episodes a day and they're short podcasts. So they have more downloads than everybody else. And so,
because downloads are counted to get you up.
Speaking, you know, this, like, so it's like a scam. And so, like, they'll be very highly ranked, but no one's ever watched it or heard of it.
I think
But they'll get quoted in magazines as being the number two podcast in the world.
Oh, dear.
But that's really what it is. It's like you figured out a way, which is nothing wrong with that. If you want to do that, you can game the system. But it doesn't matter. Like, what are you doing? Like, are you doing something that you're putting out? Like, I don't talk to anybody that I'm not interested in talking to. That's it. It's the only reason why I do this. I talk to people that I think will be fun, and I look forward to it, and I still do. That's why I do it. That's why, you know, it continues to work. Because I do it the same way I've always done it. I just talk to people that I like to talk to. No, like, oh, if I got that guy on, he's super famous. Like, that'll get a big rating.
Game the system.
Yeah. There's a lot of famous people that I've said no to because I'm just not interested in them. I'm like, yeah, maybe that'll get a lot of people, but I don't want to do that.
What I've found, the single best determinant for when I know that Modern Wisdom's going well is if I wake up on the morning of the episode and I can't wait for it to be 2 p.m.
Yes.
I'm like, fucking yes, I get to speak to such and such today. Yeah. And then I finish up and I go, I learned something. That was fucking cool. Like, that was a good 1, 2, 3, 4 hours. That was a good day. And then there's other days when I've like, I don't know, I wake up and I just think, I should have thought a little bit more about it. I'm like, I'm looking forward to this, but I'm not super fired up.
Right.
And the more that you push away from that instinct with whatever you're doing, like, because your instinct is ultimately your only competitive advantage that you have, because it's the most non-fungible thing that you've got. So Douglas Murray told me this story. It's a really fascinating one about this guy. When Douglas was first on the scene, this guy that was the head of the paper that he was at, it accumulated all of the fans and all of the foes that you would in an industry like that over the space of a couple of decades. And he decides that he's going to release a West End show about the life of Prince Charles in rhyming couplets.
This is like,
what? Okay, well, you know, you trust him, this guy, this illustrious history, so on and so forth, he must know what he's doing. And by the opening night interval, there is nobody left in the entire auditorium, including the cast. Everybody's left. And this guy is dejected, and all of the people, all of the enemies that he's accumulated throughout his career, they start sharpening the knives and they come out, and he's just despondent. Like, so, so sad. Douglas sees him a couple of weeks later and he goes, fucking West End show about the life of Prince Charles in rhyming couplets. What were you thinking? He said, Douglas, I followed my instincts. And the thing is, instincts, they may sometimes lead you wrong, but they're the only thing that's ever led you right.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.